Rosie? What's Rosie got to do with this? She hasn't been touched. We found her standing right here in the street and there isn't a mark on her. Nobody tried to jack the door open or to leave her out one of the windows. There was all that dirt and grime on her, and not so much as a handprint or a smudge. I'm having a hard time believing that 50 junkers could walk through here and not see her. Or that they could see her and not want to take a look inside. Come to think of it, I'm having a hard time believing that you and Gallagher managed to do your foraging yesterday without bumping into them. Or that they didn't see your flare. If they really are following our trail, they're missing a hell of a lot of tricks. Justin, who is looking for counter-arguments, and finding some, when she runs right into the one piece of evidence that Parks didn't see. Those sidelong looks at Caldwell. It was as though Melanie was really aiming her story at an audience of one all along, talking to the doctor over the heads of everyone else in the room. So she doesn't argue. There's no point when she's more than half sold. But she doesn't let it rest there either. She's not going to go off and interrogate Melanie without knowing what Parks's play is. Why did you do that then? She demands. Back in there. Why did I do what? Order a lockdown. If Melanie is lying, there's no danger. I didn't say that. But you didn't try to get to the truth. You acted like you believed every word. Why? Parks takes a moment to think about it. I'm not going to bet our lives on a hunch, he says. I think she's lying, but I could be wrong. It wouldn't be the first time. Bullshit, Parks. You don't second-guess yourself like that, not from what I've seen. Why didn't you at least call her on it? Parks rubs his eyes with the heel of his hand. He looks really tired all of a sudden. Tired, and maybe a little older. It meant something to her, he says. I don't know what, but unless I'm dead wrong, it's something she's way too scared to talk about. I didn't push her, because I don't have a bastard clue what kind of something that might be. So I'm asking you to find out, because I think you can get her to tell you what scared her without making it any worse for her than it is already. And I don't think I can. We don't have that kind of relationship. It's the first time since Justin who met Parks that he's actually surprised her. Without thinking about it, she leans forward and kisses him on the cheek. He freezes just a little, maybe because where she kissed is mostly scar tissue, or maybe just because he didn't see the move coming. Sorry, Justin who says.
Don't be,
Parks replies quickly, but if you don't mind me asking. It's just that you talked about her like a human being, with feelings that might sometimes have to be respected. It felt like that was an occasion that ought to be marked somehow.
Okay,
Parks says, trying that on for size.
You want to sit around and talk about her feelings some more? We could...
Later, maybe. Justin, who heads for the door. I wouldn't want to distract you from your work. Or get your hopes up, she adds to herself. Because Parks is still someone she mostly associates with blood and death and cruelty. Almost as strongly as she associates herself with those things. It really wouldn't be a good idea for the two of them to get together. They might breed or something. She goes through into the lab where she sees that Caldwell has already set up the specimen cage. It's a fold-out structure, like the airlock, but sturdy. A cube of thick wire mesh, about 4 feet on each side, supported by solid steel uprights that lock into place in brackets set into the walls of the lab. It stands in the forward corner, where it doesn't impede access to work surfaces or equipment. Melanie is sitting in the cage, knees hugged to her chest. Caldwell is doing very much what Parks is doing with the generator, overhauling a complicated piece of equipment, one of the largest in the lab, so deeply and completely absorbed that she doesn't hear Justinu come in.
Good morning, Miss Justinu, Melanie says.
Good morning, Melanie. Justinu echoes, but she's looking at Caldwell.
Whatever you're doing, she says to the doctor, it's going to have to wait. Go take a cigarette break or something. Caldwell turns. Almost for the first time, she lets her dislike of Justinu show on her face. Justinu greets it like a friend. It's really something to have got through that emotional barricade. What I'm doing is important, Caldwell says. Is it? Too bad. Get out, Caroline. I'll tell you when you can come back. For a long moment, they're face to face, almost squaring off against each other. It looks like Caldwell might go for it, damaged hands or not, but she doesn't. It's probably just as well. She looks bad enough right now that a stiff wind would knock her down, never mind a stiff punch in the head. You should examine the pleasure you take in intimidating me, Caldwell says. No, that might spoil it. You should ask yourself, Caldwell persists, why you're so keen on thinking of me as the enemy. If I make a vaccine, it might cure people like Melanie, who already have a partial immunity to Ophiocordyceps. It would certainly prevent thousands upon thousands of other children from ending up the way she has. Which weighs the most, Helen? Which will do the most good in the end, your compassion or my commitment to my work? Or could it be that you shout at me and disrespect me to stop yourself from having to ask questions like that? It could be, Justinu admits. Now do as you're told and get out. She doesn't wait for an answer. She just bundles Caldwell to the forward end of the room, pushes her through into the crew quarters and closes the door on her. The doctor is so weak that it isn't even hard. The door doesn't lock, though. Justinu waits there for a moment or two in case Caldwell tries to come back in, but the door stays closed. Finally, satisfied that they've got as much privacy as they're going to get, she goes back to the cage and kneels beside it. She stares through the bars at the small, pale face inside. Hi, she says.
Hi, Miss Justinu.
Is it okay if we... she starts to say, but then she thinks better of it. I'm coming in, she says.
No, Melanie yelps. Don't! Stay there!
As Justinu puts her hand on the door and slides back the bolt, the girl scrambles to the other end of the cage. She presses herself hard into the corner. Justinu stops, with the door half open.
You said you could only smell me a little bit, she says. Is it enough to be uncomfortable for you?
Not yet. Melanie's voice is tight.
Then we're okay. If that changes, you tell me and I'll get out. But I don't like you being in a cage like an animal, with me out there looking in. This would feel better for me, if that's okay with you.
But it's clear from Melanie's face that it's not okay. Justinu gives up. She closes the door and locks it again. Then she sits down and leans her shoulder against the mesh, legs crossed.
Okay, she says, you win. But come on over here and sit with me at least. If you're inside and I'm outside, that should be fine, right?
Melanie advances cautiously, but she stops halfway, evidently fearful of a situation that could spiral quickly out of her control.
If I tell you to get further back, you have to do it right away, Miss Justinu.
Melanie, there's a wire mesh screen in between us, and you've got your muzzle on. You can't hurt me.
I don't mean that,
Melanie says quietly. Obviously. She's talking about changing, in front of her teacher and her friend, ceasing to be herself. That prospect scares her a lot. Justinu feels ashamed, not just about the thoughtless comment, but about what she's come here to do. Melanie must have lied for a reason. Breaking down the lie feels wrong, but so does the thought of some new random factor out there that Melanie wants them all to run away from. Parks is right. They have to know.
When you went into the theatre last night, she begins tentatively.
Yes.
And saw the Junkers.
There weren't any Junkers, Miss Justinu.
Just like that?
Justinu's got her next few lines already prepared. She stares stupidly, mouth open.
No, she says.
No.
And Melanie tells her what she really saw. Running between the mildewed seats and across the booming stage, naked as the day they were born, and filthy, although their skin underneath the dirt was the same bone white as her own, their hair hanging lank and heavy, or in a few cases standing up in spikes. Some of them had sticks in their hands, and some of them had bags, old plastic bags with words on them like Food Fresh and Grocer's Market.
But I wasn't lying about the knives. They had those too. Not stabbing knives like Sergeant Parks's and Kieran's. Knives like you might cut bread or meat with in a kitchen.
15 of them, she counted. And when she made up the story of the junkers, she just added 40 more. But they weren't junkers. They were children, of every age from maybe 4 or 5 to about 15. And what they were doing was chasing rats. Some of them beating the floor and the seats with their sticks to get the rats running, others catching them when they ran, biting off their heads and dropping the limp bodies into the bags. They were much faster than the rats, so it wasn't hard for them. They made it into a game, laughing and taunting each other with shrieks and funny faces as they ran. Children like her. Children who were hungries too, and alive, and animated, and enjoying the thrill of the hunt. Until they sat down, at last, and feasted on the small, blood-drenched corpses, the big ones choosing first, the little ones pushing in between them to snatch and steal. Even that was a game, and they were still laughing. There was no threat in it.
There was a boy who seemed to be the leader. He had a big stick like a king's scepter, all shiny, and his face was painted in lots of different colours. It made him look sort of scary, but he wasn't scary to the little ones. He was protecting them. When one of the other big kids showed her teeth to one of the little ones and looked like she was going to bite him, the painted face boy put his stick on the big kid's shoulder and she stopped. But mostly, they didn't try to hurt each other. It seemed like they were a family almost. They all knew each other, and they liked being together.
It was a midnight picnic. Watching it, Melanie felt like she was looking at her own life through the wrong end of a telescope. This is what she would have been if she hadn't been taken away to the base. This is what she was supposed to be. And the way she felt about that kept changing as she thought about it. She was sad that she couldn't join the picnic. But if she hadn't gone to the base, she would never have learned so many things, and she would never have met Miss Justinu.
I started to cry, Melanie says. Not because I was sad, but because I didn't know if I was sad or not. It was like I was missing all those kids down there, even though I've never even met them, even though I didn't know their names. They probably didn't have names. It didn't seem like they could talk, because they just made these squeaking and growling sounds at each other.
The emotions that cross the little girl's face are painfully intense. Justinu puts her hand up against the side of the cage, slides her fingers through the mesh. Melanie leans forward, letting her forehead touch the tips of Justinu's fingers.
So, why didn't you tell us all this?
It's the first thing Justinu can think of to ask. She skirts around Melanie's existential crisis with instinctive caution, afraid to confront it head on. She knows Melanie won't let her go into the cage and hug her, not with that fear of losing herself. So all she has is words, and words feel inadequate for the job.
I don't mind telling you, Melanie says simply, but it has to be our secret. I don't want Dr. Caldwell to know. Or Sergeant Parks, or even Kieran.
Why not, Melanie? Justinu coaxes, and gets it as soon as she's asked. She holds up her hand to stop Melanie from saying it, but Melanie says it anyway.
They'd catch them and put them in cells under the ground,
she says. And Dr. Caldwell would cut them up. So I made up something that I thought would make Sergeant Parks want to go away really fast before anyone finds out they're here. Please say you won't tell Miss Justineau. Please, promise me.
I promise, Justineau whispers. And she means it. Whatever comes of it, she won't let Caroline Caldwell know that she's sitting right next door to a new batch of test subjects. There'll be no culling of these feral children. Which means she'll have to go back to Parks and maintain the lie. Or bring him in on it. Or come up with a better one. The two of them are silent for a moment, both presumably thinking about how this changes things between them. Back when they first left the base, she'd offered Melanie the choice between staying with them and going into one of the nearby towns. To be with your own kind, she'd almost said, and stopped herself, because she realised even as she was saying it that Melanie didn't have a kind. But now she does. While she's still thinking through the implications of what Melanie has just told her, Justineau starts to shake. For a surreal and terrifying moment she thinks it's just her, that it's some sort of seizure. But the vibration settles into a throbbing rhythm that she recognises, and there's a low rumble in her ears that crests and then dies. The throbbing dies with it as quickly as it came.
My God! Justineau gasps.
She scrambles up off the floor and runs, heading aft. Park stands over the generator, his oily hands hovering as though he's just performed a blessing, or an exorcism. Got it, he says, giving Justineau a fierce grin as she comes into the room.
But it died again, she says.
Caldwell follows her into the room. The generator's magical resurrection has brought her running too. No, it didn't. I cut it off. Don't want the noise to carry until we're ready to drive out. You never know who's listening, after all.
So we can leave, Justineau says. Keep going south. Let's roll, Parks. To hell with anything else.
He gives her a wry look. Yeah, he says. Don't want to have to tangle with those junkers. We might have to... He stops and looks past the two women, his face serious all of a sudden. Where's Gallagher? He demands. Chapter 60. Gallagher is in the wind. He's bolted. The pressure that had been building in him exploded outwards, all at once, and carried him out of there before he even registered what he was doing. It's not that he's a coward. It's more like a law of motion. Because the pressure, for him, was coming from in front as well as from behind, from the thought of what he was going back to. He just got squeezed sideways. Yeah. But it's also the thought of locking the door, turning out the lights and waiting for the junkers to find them. Like anyone could possibly miss them, just standing out there in the street. When the base fell, Gallagher saw Cy Brooks, the man who rented out his precious vintage porno mag to the whole barracks and was privately in love with the girl on page 23, get his face split open with the butt of a rifle. And Lauren Green, one of the few female privates he could talk to without getting tongue-tied, was stabbed in the stomach with a bayonet. And he would have got a helping of that, too, if Sergeant Parks hadn't grabbed him by the shoulder and hauled him away from the corner of the mess hall, where he was hiding with a terse, "I need a gunner." Gallagher has no illusions about how long he would have lasted otherwise. He was nailed to the spot with pure terror. But nailed was the wrong word, because what he was actually feeling right then was more like vertigo, as though if he moved, he was going to fall in some random direction, slantwise, across the tilting world. So he's ashamed now, to be running out on the Sarge, his saviour. But this is how you square the circle. Can't go back. Can't go forward. Can't stay put. So you pick another direction and you get out from under. The river is going to save him. There'll be boats there, left over from the old days before the breakdown. He can row or sail away and find an island somewhere with a house on it but no Hungries, and live on what he can grow or hunt or trap. He knows that Britain is an island and that there are others close to it. He's seen maps, although he doesn't remember the fine detail. How hard can it be? Explorers and pirates used to do it all the time. He's heading south with the aid of the compass from his belt. Or rather, he's trying to, but the streets don't always help. He's left the main drag where he felt way too exposed and is zigzagging his way through back streets. The compass tells him which way to go, and he follows its advice whenever the mass of avenues, crescents and cul-de-sacs allows him to. They're mercifully empty. He hasn't seen a live Hungry since he flung open Rosie's door and fled. Just a couple more of the dead ones with the trees growing out of them. He'll get to the river, which can only be another 5 miles or so, and then he'll take stock. As he walks, the rain clouds roll on past and the sun comes out again. Gallagher is surprised, in a dislocated kind of way, to see it again. The warmth and the light seem to have nothing in common with the world he's journeying through. It even makes him a little uneasy, dangerously exposed, as though the sun is a spotlight focused on him, keeping pace with him as he walks. Something else, too. He sees movement in the street ahead of him that makes him jump like a hare and all but piss himself. But then he realizes it's not in the street at all. There's nothing there. It was the shadow of something moving behind and above him, up on one of the rooftops. A junker? Didn't look big enough for that. And he's pretty sure he would have been shot in the back already if they were on him. More likely a cat or something. But shit, that was a bad moment. He's still shaking, and his stomach feels like it's going to do something that might be slightly projectile. Gallagher finds a place where the rusting remains of a car screen him from the street and sits down for a moment. He takes a drink from his canteen, which is almost empty. He's aware suddenly that there are a whole lot of things he could really do with right now, and flat out doesn't have. Like food. He didn't feel he could steal one of the backpacks when he left, so he's got nothing. Not even the packet of peanuts he'd slipped under the pillow of his bunk for later. Or his rifle. Or the empty tube of E-blocker he was going to peel open so he could rub the last nubs of gel over his underarms and crotch. He's got his sidearm and 6 clips of ammunition. He's got a little water left. He's got the compass. And he's got the grenade, which is still in the pocket of his fatigues where it's sat ever since they abandoned the Humvee. That's it. That's the whole inventory. What kind of idiot goes for a hike through enemy territory with just the clothes he's standing up in? He's got to resupply. And he's got to do it fast. The lock-up garage, where he and Justinu found the snack foods, is a couple of miles behind him now. He hates to double back and lose time, but he'd hate starving to death a whole lot more, and there's no guarantee that he'll find another motherload like that between here and the Thames. Gallagher stands up and gets himself moving again. It's not easy, but he immediately feels better, just to be doing something. He's got a defined goal and he's got a plan. He's going backwards, but only so he can go forwards again and get further this time. After 5 or 6 turns, compass or not, he's totally lost. And he's pretty much certain now that he's not alone. He doesn't see any more moving shadows, but he can hear shuffling and skittering sounds coming from somewhere really close by. Whenever he pauses to listen, there's nothing. But it's right there behind the sound of his own footsteps when he starts walking again. Someone is moving when he moves, stopping when he stops. It sounds like they're almost on top of him. He ought to be able to see them, but he can't. He can't even be sure what direction they're coming from. But the shadow he saw, that was definitely cast by something up on the roof. If he's being stalked, Gallagher thinks,
That would be a great way for the stalker to stay close to him without being seen. Okay. So let's see them jump clear across the street. He breaks into a run without warning, sprints across the street and then sidelong into an alley. Across a sort of parking area behind some burnt-out shops, through one of the gaping back doors, into a narrow hallway. A vulcanized rubber swing door, rotten and sticky to the touch, takes him onto the sales floor, which Gallagher crosses quickly and slows. Then stops. Because this is some sort of mini-market, with about 6 cramped aisles and shelves from floor to ceiling. On the shelves, toilet brushes, egg cups in the shape of smiling chicks, tin bread bins decorated with Union Jacks, wooden mousetraps with their name, the Little Nipper, stamped on their sides, cheese graters with easy grip handles, chopping boards, tea towels, novelty condiment sets, bin liners, car seat protectors, magnetic screwdrivers, and food. Not much of it, just one section of shelving at the end of an aisle, but the tins and the packets don't seem to have been touched. They're still neatly arrayed by type, all the soups on one shelf, foreign cuisine on another, rice and pasta on a third. Just as some anonymous and probably long-dead retail grunt set them out on what must have seemed like an ordinary morning, in a world that nobody thought could end. The tins are blown, every one of them. They're full in the sun right now, as they must have been on every sunny day going back to before Gallagher was even born. But there are packets, too. He examines them first with hope, and then with excitement. Gourmet's Feast chicken curry with rice. Just add water. Gourmet's Feast beef stroganoff. Just add water. Gourmet Feast mixed meat paella. Just add water. In other words, desiccated foods in airtight sachets. Gallagher tears one open and takes a tentative sniff. It smells pretty bloody good, all things considered. And he really doesn't care whether or not this stuff ever met a chicken or a cow, as long as he can keep it down. He pours in about a third of his remaining water, grips the neck of the sachet tight and shakes it for half a minute or so. Then he opens it and squeezes a dollop of the resulting paste straight into his mouth. It's delicious. A gourmet's feast, just like it says on the label. And he doesn't even need to chew. It slides down as easy as soup. The slight grittiness doesn't bother him either, until some of the unmixed powder accidentally goes down his throat, and he breaks into a fit of explosive coughing, anointing all the packets left on the shelf with brown flecks of curried spit. He finishes off the packet with a bit more caution. Then he rips open a few more of them, discarding the cardboard sleeves and stuffing his many pockets with the food sachets. When he reaches the river, he'll celebrate with 2 or 3 of them chosen at random. A mix-and-match supper. Speaking of which, he really should get going. But he can't resist casting a quick eye over the rest of the store, wondering what other marvels it might contain. When he finds the magazine rack, Gallagher's heart leaps. The entire top shelf, 10 feet or more of display space, is full of porno mags. He takes them down, one after another, and turns the pages as reverently as if they contained holy writ. Women of inconceivable beauty smile back at him with love, understanding and welcome. Their legs and hearts are wide open. If he was still at the base, this treasure trove would make him rich beyond measure. Pilgrims would come from every barracks to pay him in tobacco and alcohol for a half hour in the company of these ladies. The fact that he doesn't smoke, and fears alcohol almost as badly as he fears hungries and junkers, does nothing to tarnish this dazzling vision. He'd be the man, nonetheless. One of those guys who gets a nod or a word from everybody when he walks into the mess hall and takes it as his due. A man whose acknowledgement, when granted, confers status on those who get a nod or a word in return. The creak of a floorboard startles Gallagher back from eternal glory into the here and now. He lowers the magazine that's in his hands. 10 feet away, hidden until that moment by the magazine, although she's not making any effort to conceal herself, is a girl. She's tiny, naked, skinny as a bag of sticks. For a startling moment, she looks like a black and white photograph, because her hair is jet and her skin is pure, unmitigated white. Her eyes are as black and bottomless as holes drilled through a board. Her mouth is a straight, bloodless line. She could be 5 or 6 years old, or an emaciated 7. She just stands there, staring at Gallagher. Then when she's sure she's got his attention, she holds out her hand and shows him what she's holding. It's a dead rat without a head. Gallagher looks from the rat to the girl's face, then back to the rat. They stand like that for what feels like a long time. Gallagher sucks in a long, tremulous breath. "Hey," he says at last, "how are you doing?" It's about the stupidest line you could come up with, but he's having a really hard time believing this is happening. This little girl is a hungry, that's obvious. But she's one of the Melanie kind of hungries that can think and doesn't have to eat people if she doesn't want to. And she's giving him a peace offering, a pretty major one, given how agonizingly thin she is. But she doesn't make a move towards him, and she doesn't say anything. Can she even speak? The kids at the base were more like animals when they were first brought in. They learned to talk pretty quickly once they heard other people talking, but he remembers them squealing like little piglets or chittering like chimps to start with. Doesn't matter. There's other stuff. Body language. Gallagher gives the girl a big, wide smile and a friendly wave. She's still not moving, and her face is as rigid as a mask. She just jiggles the rat at him, the way you do for a dog. "You're a very pretty little girl," Gallagher tells her inanely. "What's your name?" "My name's Kieran. Kieran Gallagher." The rat jiggles again. The girl's mouth opens and closes as though she's miming eating. This is ridiculous. He's going to have to take the rat, or the impasse will go on forever. Gallagher puts down the porno mag very slowly, face down, as if this living, dead kid were capable of being embarrassed or corrupted by the bare breasts on the cover. He shows her his empty hands. Moving in the gradual, strolling gait Sergeant Parks taught him, he advances on her, one step at a time. He's careful to keep his hands in full view and the smile on his face the whole time. He reaches out one hand, very slowly, for the rat. The little brat hauls it back, out of his reach. Gallagher stops dead, wondering if maybe he's misunderstood. Pain explodes in his left leg, then his right, sudden and astonishing. He screams and falls, both legs buckling under him so that he hits the floor as heavy and ungainly as a toppled wardrobe. Diminutive figures flee away on both sides of him from the intersecting aisle where they'd been crouching, hidden. He doesn't get a good look at them because he's in pain, and he's angry, and he's too thoroughly confused even to realise at first what it is that's just happened. He levers himself up on one elbow and looks down at his feet, but he can't process what he's seeing. There's red everywhere. Blood. It's blood, and it's his. He knows that because he can feel it now as well as see it. The backs of his calves pulse and throb agonizingly. From the knees down, his trousers are already saturated. "What did they do?" he wonders dazedly. "What did they just do to me?" He catches a blur of movement in his peripheral vision and he turns. Another little kid is rushing on him. His face is a bright splash of random color, in which his eyes show out as two black pinpricks. His arm is raised high, and he's holding a shining metal something over his head that glints blindingly in the slanting afternoon light. Gallagher flinches away with a shriek of terror as the boy swings. For a moment he thinks the weapon is a sword, but as it flashes past him, he sees that it's too fat, too solid. The metal shelf unit takes most of the force of the blow. Gallagher brings his arm up to smack the kid in the chest, backhanded, and the kid weighs nothing, so the blow sends him spinning head over heels. The weapon, it's an aluminium baseball bat, flies out of his hand and clatters at Gallagher's feet, which are now in an actual puddle, a puddle of his own blood. The painted-faced kid scrambles away, but there's two more of them running in now from either side, one with a knife and the other swinging what looks like a butcher's cleaver. Gallagher screams again at the top of his voice and snatches up the baseball bat. The hungry kids abort their attack runs, back pedal right out of his reach. But they're everywhere now. Gallagher can't see how many, but it seems like dozens. Hundreds, maybe. Little, pale faces peer at him through the gaps in the shelves, duck in and out of view. Bolder ones crowd the ends of the aisles, staring at him openly. They're armed with everything under the sun, from knives and forks to broken branches. They're mostly stark naked like the girl, but some are wearing weirdly assorted clothes that must have been looted from shop displays. One boy has a leopard print bra fastened diagonally across his upper body, tied at the bottom end to a webbing belt, from which a whole bunch of ornamental keyrings are hanging. The little girl he saw first is still standing there, Gallagher sees now. She's just stepped back a little to give the ones with the weapons a bit more room. She's chewing on the dead rat, calm and patient. Gallagher tries to get up, but his legs won't bear his weight. He can't take his eyes off the kids in case they attack again, so he reaches down with his free hand to try and figure out by feel what it is that's happened to him. There's a broad rent in the right leg of his trousers, halfway between knee and ankle. Gingerly, he reaches through it to touch the edges of the wound. It's not wide, but it's long, and it's straight, and you have to figure it's deep. Same with the left leg. The rat wasn't a peace offering. It was bait. And it shouldn't have worked, because he doesn't eat rat. But hey, what do you know? He's a sucker for a pretty face. The little moppet manoeuvred him into position, and then two of her friends sliced him up from behind. He's been hamstrung. He's not walking out of here. He may never walk again. Fuck! Gallagher is surprised when the word comes out of him as a whisper. In his mind, it was a shout. Listen, he says aloud. Listen to me. This is not... You're not going to do this to me. You understand? You can't... The faces he's seeing don't change. The same expression on all of them. Wild, aching need somehow reined in, somehow not acted on. They're waiting for him to die, so they can eat him. He takes out his sidearm and points it. At the girl. Then at the kid who dropped the baseball bat. He looks to be one of the oldest. He's got incongruously red, full lips, when most of them barely have lips at all. You don't notice that at first because of the paint all over his face, which Gallagher realises is not abstract. It's another face, kind of a monster's face painted over his own, the open mouth encompassing everything from his nose to his chin. The work is smudgy enough, and wobbly enough to suggest that he did it himself, probably in marker pen. His lank, black hair hangs straight down over his eyes, giving him a louche, rock star look. He's so skinny, Gallagher can count every rib, nose to his chin. The work is smudgy enough, and wobbly enough to suggest that he did it himself, probably in marker pen. His lank, black hair hangs straight down over his eyes, giving him a louche, rock star look. He's so skinny, Gallagher can count every rib. And the gun doesn't bother him at all. He stares right past it, unblinking, into Gallagher's eyes. Gallagher waves the gun at the other kids, one by one. They don't even seem to see it. They don't know what a gun is, or why they should be afraid of one. He's going to have to shoot at least one of them to make them get it. Better do it quick, too. His hand is trembling, and there's a sort of fuzzy static behind his eyes. The world's starting to jump a little, like a car on a bumpy road. He tries to focus through the shakes. Painted face boy. The one who dropped the baseball bat. He's right at the front of the crowd, and he's probably the one in charge of Operation Eat Kieran Gallagher. So fuck him. He's duly nominated. But he keeps moving. They all keep moving. Might hit the little girl if he's not careful. For some reason, Gallagher doesn't want to do that, even though she's set him up. She's too small. It would feel too much like murder. There he is, the little bastard. Target acquired. The gun feels like it weighs a couple of hundredweight, but Gallagher only needs to hold it on the right line for a couple of seconds. Just time enough to squeeze, squeeze, and... The trigger doesn't move. The clip's empty. Gallagher used it up on the second day when they were running through the crowd of Hungries to get into that hospital place, Wainwright House. Then he switched to the rifle, and it's the rifle he's had in his hands ever since whenever it seemed like they might have to fight. He's never reloaded. He almost laughs. The kids haven't even reacted because the gun doesn't mean a damn thing to them. It's the baseball bat that's keeping them at bay. Except it's not. Not anymore. They're advancing slowly from both ends of the aisle, creeping in closer to him a step or two at a time, like they're on a dare. Painted face boy is leading the pack, even though he doesn't have a weapon anymore. His bony fingers flex and contract. Numbness is creeping over Gallagher now, seeping up through his body from his wounded legs. But the terror effervescing in his mind keeps it back and brings a sudden inspiration. Quickly he shifts onto his left side so he can feel in the pockets of his fatigues for... Yes. There it is. His hand closes on the cold metal. Hail Mary, he thinks incredulously, full of grace. The kids are really close. Gallagher pulls the grenade from his pocket and holds it out for them to see. Look, he yells. Look at this. The inexorable advance slows and stops, but he knows it's the shout and not the danger that has made the kids hesitate. They're gauging how much fight he has left in him. Boom! Gallagher mimes an explosion, throwing his arms out wildly. Silence for a moment. Then Painted Face Boy barks back at him. He thinks it's just a threat display, a pissing contest. And the kids are moving again, closing in for the kill. It's a bomb! Gallagher shouts desperately. It's a fucking grenade! It will rip you apart! Go and eat a stray dog or something. I'll do it. I mean it. I'll really do it. No reaction. He takes the pin between thumb and forefinger. He doesn't want to kill them. Just to make sure his own exit is a white light and a sudden shock, rather than something drawn out and horrible, beyond his capacity to endure. It's not like they've left him a choice. He doesn't have any choice at all. Please, he says. Nothing. And when it comes to it, he can't do it. If he could make them understand what it was he was threatening them with, maybe it would be different. He drops the baseball bat, and the feral children take him like a wave. The grenade is knocked out of his hand and rolls away. I don't want to hurt you, Gallagher shrieks. And it's the truth. So he tries not to fight back as they clutch and bite and tear at him. They're just kids, and their childhood has probably been as big a load of shit as his was. In a perfect world, he would have been one of them. Chapter 61. Parks is determined to search, even though he knows the chance of finding Gallagher is close to zero. They can't shout, and they can't throw up any kind of a grid, because it's just the three of them. Himself, Helen Justineau, and the kid. Dr. Caldwell claimed she was too weak to walk very far, and since she looks as though a harsh word would break her in two, he didn't argue the point. But they don't need a grid. Melanie turns herself around like a weathercock, sniffs the wind a couple of times. She ends up facing a little bit west of south.
That way.
You're sure? Parks asks her. A nod. No wasted words. She leads the way. But the trail goes all over the place, up one road and down another, mostly keeping southerly at first, but then not even that. Gallagher seems to have doubled back on himself when he was only a mile or so out from Rosie. Parks wonders if the kid might be stringing them along for some reason, to look important maybe, and to have the grown-ups' attention. But that's bullshit. Maybe a 10-year-old with a pulse would pull a trick like that, but Melanie's more grounded. If she didn't know where Gallagher went, she'd just say so. There's something else going on, though, and it's between Melanie and Justineau, a dialogue of scared glances that reaches a crescendo at the point where the trail crosses a street into a back alley. The kid stops and looks at him.
"Get out your gun, Sergeant," she says quietly.
She's gone way solemn. "Hungries?" He doesn't care how she knows. He just wants to be clear about what he's walking into.
"Yes."
"Where?" The kid hesitates. They're in a sort of parking apron behind some shops. Lots of doorways on three sides of them, mostly broken open or broken down. A rusting car off on one side that's up on bricks, probably already immobile long before the breakdown silenced the roads. Wheelie bins laid out in a long line for a collection that never came.
"There,"
Melanie says at last. The doorway she nods towards is at first glance no different from any of the others. Second glance takes in the trodden-down weeds right in front of it, one of them a monster thistle that's still wet with sap where it was broken. Parks goes to silent running. Better late than never, he figures. He taps Justineau's hand, indicates that she should take out her handgun. The two of them approach the door like cops in a pre-breakdown TV drama, exaggeratedly furtive despite the crunch and grind of their footsteps on the broken ground. Melanie steps in between and turns to face them.
"Cut me loose," she says to Parks.
He looks her in the eye. "Hands?"
"Hands and mouth."
"Not that long ago you asked me to tie you up," he reminds her.
"I know. I'll be careful."
She doesn't need to say the rest out loud. If they're walking into an enclosed space full of hungries, they'll probably need her. Can't argue with that. Parks unlocks the cuffs, slides them into his belt. Melanie undoes the muzzle for herself and hands it to him.
"Will you look after this for me, please?" she asks.
He pockets it, and Melanie walks before them into the darkness. But they're coming late to the party. Whatever happened here, it's already over. A broad, smeared trail of blood leads from the centre of an aisle into a corner out of the sun, which is where the Hungries took Gallagher so they could eat him. He stares straight at the ceiling, with a look of patient suffering on his face, like the more mannerly depictions of Christ on the cross. Unlike Christ, he's been chewed down to the bone in most places. His jacket is gone. No sign of it anywhere. His shirt, ripped wide open, frames the hollow chasm of his torso. His dog tags have fallen among exposed vertebrae. The Hungries appear somehow to have eaten his throat without breaking the steel chain, like that party trick where you whip out the tablecloth without disturbing the crockery. Justineau turns away, tears squeezed out from her closed eyes, but she makes no sound. Neither does Parks, for a moment or two. All he can think of is that he had a command of one, and he let the boy die alone. That's the sort of sin you go to hell for.
We should bury him,
Melanie says. For a moment his anger turns on her. Fuck's the point, he growls, glaring at her. They didn't leave enough to bury. You could scoop him up and drop him in a frigging litter bin. Melanie meets him more than halfway. Teeth bared, she snarls right back at him.
We have to bury him, or dogs and other hungries will get him and eat even more of him. And there won't be anywhere to show where he died. You should honour a fallen soldier, Sergeant. Honour a... Where the fuck did that come from?
The Trojan War, most likely, Justinu mutters. She wipes her eyes with the heel of her hand. Melanie, we can't...
There isn't anywhere, and we don't have the time. We'd just be making ourselves into targets. We're going to have to leave him. If we can't bury him, Melanie says, then we have to burn him. With what? Justinu demands. With the stuff in the big barrels, Melanie says impatiently. From the room with the generator in it. It says inflammable on it, and that means it burns.
Justinu says something else, trying to explain maybe why dragging 20-gallon drums of aviation fuel through the streets is another activity that they won't be engaging in. But Parks is thinking, with a sort of dull wonder. As far as the kid is concerned, the world never ended. They taught her all these old, old things, filled her head with all this unserviceable shit, and they thought it didn't matter because she was never going to leave her cell except to be dismantled and smeared on microscope slides. His stomach lurches. He has a sense, for the first time in his soldiering career, of what a war crime might look like from the inside. And it's not him who's the criminal, or even Caldwell. It's Justinu, and Mailer, and that drunken bastard Whittaker, and all the rest of them. Caldwell, she's just a butcher. She's Sweeney Todd with a barber's chair and a straight razor. She didn't spend years twisting kids' brains into pretzels.
We can say a prayer for him, Justinu is saying now. But we can't drag one of those fuel drums all the way here, Melanie. And even if we could...
Okay, Park says. Let's do it.
Justinu looks at him like he's gone mad. This isn't a joke, she tells him grimly.
Do I look like I'm joking? Hey, she's right. She's making more sense than either of us.
We can't, Justinu says again.
Parks loses it.
Why the hell not? He roars. If she wants to honour the fucking dead, let her do it. School's out, teacher. School's been out for days now. Maybe you missed that.
Justinu stares at him in bewilderment. Her face is a little pale.
You shouldn't shout, she mutters, making shushing motions with her hands.
Did I get moved to your class? Parks asks her. Are you my teacher now?
The Hungries that did this are probably still close enough to hear you. You're giving away our position.
Parks raises his rifle and squeezes off a round, making Justinu flinch and yelp. The shot punches a hole in the ceiling. Clods of damp plaster thud down, one of them bouncing off Parks' shoulder and leaving a white streak where it hit. I would welcome a word or two with them, he says. He turns to Melanie, who's watching all this with wide eyes. It must be like seeing Mummy and Daddy quarrel. What do you say, kid? Shall we give Kieran a Viking funeral?
She doesn't answer. She's caught between a rock and a hard place, because if she says yes, then she's siding with him against Justinu, and there's no way that crush is subsiding any time soon.
Parks takes silence for consent. He goes around behind the counter, where he's already seen a box of disposable lighters. They're still full of fluid, only a few cc's in each one, but there are about 100 of them. He brings them back to the pathetic remains. Being a man of a practical turn of mind, he takes the walkie-talkie from Gallagher's belt and transfers it to his own, before breaking open the little plastic tubes one at a time and emptying the lighter fluid out onto Gallagher's corpse. Justinu watches, shaking her head.
"What about the smoke?" she asks him.
"What about it?" Parks grunts.
Melanie turns her back on the two of them and walks down the aisle, all the way to the front of the shop. She comes back a moment later, carrying a bright yellow cagoule in a plastic wrapper. She kneels and puts it under Gallagher's head. She's kneeling in his blood, which isn't even dry yet. When she stands again, red-black streaks adorn her knees and calves. Parks gets to the last lighter. He could use it to light the pyre, but he doesn't. He pours it on, like the rest, then strikes a spark with his tinderbox to start the blaze.
"God bless, Private," he mutters,
as the flames consume what little is left of Kieran Gallagher. Melanie is saying something too, but it's under her breath. To the dead body, not to the rest of them, and Parks can't hear. Justinu, to do her justice, waits in silence until they're done, which is basically when the greasy, stinking flames force them back. They make the return trip to Rosie a lot more widely spaced than on the outward journey, and with a lot less to say to each other. The shop blazes behind them, sending up a thick pillar of smoke that spreads, far over their heads, into a black umbrella. Justinu is treating Parks like a dog that's showing a little foam around the gums, which he feels is probably more than fair right then. Melanie walks ahead of them both, shoulders hunched and head lowered. She hasn't asked for her cuffs and muzzle to be replaced, and Parks hasn't offered. When they're most of the way back, the kid stops. Her head snaps up, suddenly alert.
"What's that?" she whispers.
Parks is about to say he can't hear anything, but there is a vibration in the air, and now it assembles itself into a sound. Something stirring into wakefulness, sullen and dangerous, asserting its readiness to pick a fight and win it. Rosie's engines. Parks breaks into a run, turning the corner of the Finchley High Road in time to see the distant speck grow in seconds into a behemoth. Rosie weaves a little, both because there's debris in the road and because Dr. Caldwell is driving with her thumbs hooked into the bottom of the steering wheel. Every twitch of her arm translates into a yawning roll of the long vehicle. Without even thinking about it, Parks steps into the road. He has no idea what Caldwell is doing, what she might be fleeing from, but he knows he has to stop her. Rosie lurches like a drunk to miss him, smashing into a parked car, which is dragged along with it for a few hundred yards before breaking apart in a shower of rust and glass. Then it's gone. They're staring at the mobile lab's taillights as it accelerates away from them.
"What the fuck?"
Justinu exclaims in a bewildered tone. Parks seconds that emotion. Chapter 62. As soon as Parks and Justinu go off in search of Private Gallagher, taking test subject number one with them, Caroline Caldwell crosses to Rosie's midsection door, opens up a compartment beside it at about head height, and pulls a lever from the vertical position to the horizontal. This is the override control for the external emergency access. Nobody can now enter the vehicle unless Caldwell lets them in herself. That done, she goes to the cockpit and powers up one of three panels. The generator, 20 yards behind her in the rear of the vehicle, starts to hum, but not to roar, because Caldwell isn't sending the power to the engine. She needs it in the lab, which is where she goes next. Since she'll be working directly with infected tissue, she puts on gloves, goggles, and face mask. She boots up the scanning electron microscope, works her way patiently and punctiliously through the setting and display option screens, and mounts the first of her prepared slides. With a pleasant tingle of anticipation, she puts her eyes to the output rig. The central nervous system of the Wainwright House Hungry is instantly there, laid out before her avid gaze.
Having chosen green as the key colour, she finds herself strolling under a canopy of neuronal dendrites, a tropical brain forest. The resolution is so perfect, it takes Dr. Caldwell's breath away. Gross and